I want to speak today about giants, not the team, the internal locus of motivation, and the limitations of emotion. And I want to do it by going old school and presenting an old style sermon, a style I probably haven't given in a long time, which is going to be generated from a single verse in our Parsha, chapter 13, verse 33, in which the scouts say, and they're reporting about the land, V'sham ra'inu et ha'nifilim b'nei anak min ha'nifilim unhi b'einenu kechagavim v'ken hayinu b'einehem. And it was there that we saw the Nephilim, the fallen ones, the sons of giants. And from these Nephilim, compared with them, we were in our eyes like grasshoppers, and we were grasshoppers in their eyes also. I've always been attracted to this line for many reasons, but I decided to actually track it down and get a sense of how our tradition has approached this line in which the scouts viewed themselves as grasshoppers. And something interesting came about, a certain uniformity in understanding this verse, which surprised me, because normally our commentators bring out very different perspectives. Rashi, first of all, drawing on an older Midrashic tradition, tells us that this is literally true, and that they were like ants in the vineyard. These B'nai Anak, these Nephilim or giants, are speaking to each other and saying that there are human-like ants in the vineyards. The Midrash from which he draws from has these Nephilim coming, and the Israelite scouts get very scared, and they clamber up these trees to hide. And there in the trees, they overhear these giant people talking one to the other and saying indeed that, wow, did you see those ants that look like humans in the vineyard? You'll notice that our Torah says grasshoppers, and here Rashi, referring to the Midrash, speaks about ants. But there's a literality to Rashi in this comment, which is fascinating. The Midrash itself, from the Talmud and Sota, questions this and says, Mana havo yade, how did they know, how did the scouts know how they appeared to the Nephilim, to these fallen children of giants? And the Midrash, I think, intimates at some level of falsehood. Because, of course, you know how you feel, but how on earth would they have known how these others feel? And yet, strangely, our medieval commentators in the Mikraot Gedolot, that basic source of Jewish identity and belief and understanding as to what the Talmud means, continue Rashi's sort of perspective and this negative notion, which dispels, I think they're so concerned that the Israelites might be viewed as liars, that they confirm Rashi's comment. And they all do this. Or HaChaim, Baal HaTorim, Sforno, Rashbam, Ramban, Kli Yakar, they all admit that indeed they were like grasshoppers in comparison to these giant people. In fact, Kli Yakar's main concern, one of my favorite commentators, Polish, 1600s, I guess, he says he wants to resolve the difference between ants and grasshoppers, and he teaches us about perspective. He says, you know, when someone's far away, they look smaller, and when they're up close, they look bigger. So they were like grasshoppers, but the Nephilim were so far away that a grasshopper only looked like an ant. This is the help our classic commentators are giving us in this verse. And in the Talmud, Sota, looking at this and pointing out the obvious, it's a very, very strange sort of hyper-literalism that our commentators approach over and over again. Sometimes when that happens, as with the flood story, It makes me wonder if we're dealing here with a very, very ancient piece of prehistory. Were there perhaps giants who walked the land? You know, there's a point in history where some of our scholars said there never could have been such a flood. But if you look at ancient parallel stories, this flood story shows up again and again. And there's a very strong possibility and some evidence even that indeed there was a primeval flooding of that Near Eastern basin. So certainly those of a different era of scholarship wondered, perhaps there really were giants. And they began to look to paleontologists and to go back to the ancient record to try to figure out who and what those giants might be. There's evidence such as the Java giant or the Meganthropus, who was apparently about 8 feet tall, perhaps an early hominid who would have weighed about 500 pounds. There's also records of a Chinese giant, Gigantopithecus, that would have been, according to some estimates, 12 feet tall. But the more recent paleontologists really think that those weren't humanoid in any way. Those are really part of the ape line. And so even in the last year, there was a report of finding the skeleton of a very large hominid. Now, in case you didn't know it, I actually am not a paleontologist. I don't play one in TV. And I am not educated enough to make an intelligent decision as to what the fossil record shows, though I suspect that probably these were not humans, but some other line of creatures. So were they referring to that? I don't know, but what we do know is that the Torah again and again is called on as an eternal book, which means that it has to speak to us in our day. It has to have meaning for us. And I don't know about you, but that tells me is that referring to giants isn't really going to get us too far in mining meaning out of the Torah. So we'll leave it there as a possibility, but we'll move on perhaps to other sorts of commentators. And it's interesting, it's not until the fifth generation of the Hasidic masters that you begin to see movement away from this literal reading of the verse. And we find it, I think, most strongly in a very powerful and simple line of Menachem Mendel of Kotz, the Kotzker. And he says regarding this, V'chen hayinu be'einehem, ma b'kach, ma ikpat lecha, ech ata nere b'einei acharim. What's up? What do you care? What do you care how you appear in the eyes of others? Now, you have to know something about the Kotzker. He was a truth teller who told the truth in a rather harsh, direct way, who holed himself in his office in the latter years and had little human interaction. So we know certainly that the Kotzker himself didn't really care what others thought of him. He sort of abdicated his leadership for that. But he brings up a powerful point about internal motivation. And so many of us, I think, in our lives are reading the signals of others around us and making judgments about whether we can act a certain way, whether we can get away with something. Are we okay based on what others think? And I think there's an issue of authenticity, which the Kotzker often wrote about, that comes into jeopardy and which our Torah verse highlights. If we are not internally motivated, indeed how we appear to others will control our lives. Now, if we take that too far, we end up in the path of the sociopath. I think we want to be aware of how others view us. I think we want to care about how others view us. But if we lose that internal motivation, we will be completely controlled by how others see us. And in the case of the Israelites, it put their entire national project in jeopardy, because the 10 spies who came back saying this said indeed that because they viewed us this way, we're unable to fulfill the dictate and enter into the land. The final insight I want to offer, I guess, comes more from modern biology, neurobiology, and psychology, and my own thinkings, which really touches upon the limitations of emotion. And it requires us to focus and remember the difference between feeling and emotion. Feeling, like the Kotzke reminds us, is something that for the most part comes from external stimulus. You feel a moment of heat or pain, the stove is hot, you let it go. You look at someone who scares you and you feel a moment of fear, and then that feeling dissipates. But emotion is something different. Emotion is the way that we interpret momentary feelings and frame them in our lives. And when we do that, they transform from a momentary external stimulus into something that we carry with us. Emotions, in other words, are long-enduring. Some emotions, like love, we certainly hope are long-enduring. Hatred also, we know, can be nurtured for years by those who get caught in its web. And so what this verse also, I think, reminds me of is that the scouts were not guilty for feeling fear. If indeed these were giant, oversized people, anyone would have a right to have a moment of panic. But what they were guilty of was transforming that momentary fear into an emotion they carried with them, such that they gave a bad report of the land and almost undermined everything that the people had been working for. So I leave you with those thoughts, because I think in all of our lives, we struggle to get that balance down between what others think of us and what our tasks in this world are. And too often, we carry the past with us, a momentary flicker, and turn it into a blinding light that keeps us from ever being able to see the present and what is in front of us at this moment. May we learn from the failures of the Miraglim of the Scouts, and may we find a way to be compassionate and concerned with others, even as we follow our own deepest impulses and passions. Shabbat Shalom.